As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
How their this endemic corruption has degraded their capability, their ability to, fight, and they're losing every day. The soldiers have lost the will to fight, and as a result, they're having to, abduct people to serve in the military. So, that type of force is not a very capable or effective force. So that's on the military side. On the resistance side, as I said, the resilience has been unexpected.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel of the United States Army, retired, and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 39, Myanmar's four-year struggle. 4 years ago, on February 1st, 2021, Myanmar's military, known as the Tatmadaw, seized power in a coup, toppling the democratically elected government and plunging the country into a brutal conflict. Many expected the Tatmadaw to quickly consolidate control, as in previous crackdowns. But this time was different. What began as peaceful protests and mass strikes quickly escalated into armed resistance, fueled by military defections and growing cooperation between the ethnic armed groups and pro-democracy forces. Today, after 4 years of relentless conflict, the junta's hold on the country has eroded drastically. Recent reports indicate the military controls approximately 21% of Myanmar's territory, with resistance groups holding about 42% and the remaining areas contested. Yet democracy remains elusive. Myanmar continues to be a battlefield with devastating consequences for its people. More than 3.5 million have been displaced. And the country has become a hub for organized crime, human trafficking, and illicit drug production. Cities and villages have been leveled by airstrikes, entire communities uprooted, and humanitarian access remains severely restricted. Despite rising instability, the international response has remained cautious. While Western nations have condemned the junta and imposed sanctions, they've done little to decisively shape the outcome of the conflict. Meanwhile, China has played a multifaceted role in Myanmar's crisis. Beijing has long viewed Myanmar as a critical component of its regional strategy, a land bridge to the Indian Ocean, and a key supplier of resources. Initially, China maintained relations with both the junta and various ethnic armed groups to safeguard its interests. As the conflict has persisted, Beijing has increasingly aligned itself with the military regime. In November 2024, Chinese Premier Li Qiang reaffirmed support of Myanmar's junta leader, emphasizing China's commitment to regional stability and its strategic investments. This alignment underscores Myanmar's significance as a battleground in broader regional power dynamics. What comes next for Myanmar? Can the resistance push the junta out entirely? Will the country collapse into a failed state, fragmented among warring factions? Or can diplomacy offer a way forward? What role should the international community play in shaping Myanmar's future? And what lessons can we learn from other prolonged conflicts like Syria? Guiding us through this critical discussion is Dr. Mimi Nguyen Bird, one of the foremost experts on Myanmar's security. A retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and professor at DKI APCSS, Dr. Bird brings professional expertise and personal perspective to this issue. She's also the author of the newly released chapter, Myanmar, the Strategic Blind Spot, Undermining U.S. Interests in the Indo-Pacific, where she analyzed the conflict's geopolitical stakes, China's influence, and the resilience of Myanmar's resistance. Mimi Nguyen Bird, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you for having me.
Oh man, it has been a year since we sat down here together. Where has that time gone? that back then I asked you, and I'm going to ask you again, tell us a little bit about your story. How did you come to this space? How is it you've become extremely well respected in the field? Tell us.
Well, because I was originally born and raised in Myanmar, and then my family immigrated to the United States in 1980. I still retain some level of language
Of
skill.
course.
So, in as you know, in the U.S. military, there's not too many people that really focus on Myanmar at the time. There are a lot more, I think, Myanmar diaspora serving in the service now in our armed forces. But back then, I was one of the few people. So as a result, it ended up landing on my lap as a topical area that I have to give briefing on or research. So that's how I become more focused in on it. And now today, because of the conflict and my background and with the US military, I get called upon a lot by even the Burmese people, Myanmar people, and the US government to try to understand what is happening in Myanmar.
I mean, you've been retired for several years. How long have you been at the center now as a professor?
18
18
years.
years. So, you're talking about several decades time period of where you've been doing this. And so, well, we are of course all beneficiaries of the experience you bring on this field. And I as a friend, as I have benefited over many of these years talking about this. And so look forward to our discussion today. So let's just dive into it.
Okay.
Maybe the best place, I gave a bit of an opening, but
Yes.
maybe you can give us a bit more of the state of the conflict. I mean, like I said, it's entered its fourth year, right? The resistance forces have gained momentum. The junta's losing control. So here's a question: where do things currently stand, and what are the most critical developments that are shaping the battlefield today?
The resist resilience, as you said, it has been unexpected
Hmm.
for those who are, a casual observer to the conflict. For some of us who has followed Myanmar security dynamics, it was kind of expected because of the junta's internal workings. Junta is endemically corrupt, and that corruption has eaten away its capability. And on and that endemic corruption, it's collapsing under its own corruption. And I have said it in the previous dialogue, how their this endemic corruption is degraded their capability, their ability to fight, and they're losing every day. The soldiers have lost the will to fight, and as a result, they're having to abduct people to serve in the military. So that type of force is not a very capable or effective force. So that's on the military side. On the resistance side, as I said, the resilience has been unexpected because at the beginning, everybody said, oh, military will win again, right? Because of the history, because they firepower wise, they're far out.
Gun the other ones, yeah.
Yes, then the resistance side. But the resistance, the key has been the people continue to support the resistance and reject the military. The last data we had was over 80% still support the resistant forces, and 20%, less than 20%, really support the junta. So that's the people power. And second is the unprecedented cooperation between all these coalition of resistance forces, ethnic armed groups, as well as the within the Burma population, the local they call it People Defense Forces. They're coming together in an unprecedented way that is giving resiliency to the resistance movement.
You know, the many topics I lecture here, security sector governance falls in there, and we talk about corruption. And then, I spent years doing Afghanistan, and we think about how quickly Afghanistan fell. And part of that, a lot of that, may be a factor of corruption that was going on in the government. And so, your point about how corruption is just eating the tamadaw and making it less effective, resonates with what I've experienced and what I've seen. And so, thanks for a foot stomp in that. So let's talk a little bit now about China's strategic role. I mean, China has positioned itself as a key player in Myanmar's crisis. I mean, frankly, this has been going on for it has been a key player in Myanmar for a very long time. But it leverages its economic interests, its political influence, and it adapts to these shifting realities that are going on, right? This is China. So let me ask you the question. How has Beijing's strategy towards Myanmar evolved over these past 4 years? And then what is its ultimate objective? What does it want?
Right. Well, I think it wants a government that they can control and they can exploit and manipulate, right? And when it is a dictatorship or authoritarian regime, it is easier for them to control that way. And that has been their motive operandum. And so they spend a lot of time, you know, propping up the military regime. And especially when they realize, when China realized that military regime was about to collapse. So they put, you know, a lot of effort behind to try to prop it up with the resources, giving them more resources, as well as pressuring the northern armed groups from fighting with the military. So, but I think I think China may be on the wrong side of history on this one.
How so?
Because they seem to understand the elite. They really understand the elite, but they don't understand the people. And this support, clear support for the junta, has created huge anti-China sentiment within Myanmar.
That must manifest a little bit in, I mean, China has personnel that are in China. We got the CMEC, right? The China-Myanmar Economic Corridor. They've asked for the junta to provide security for its people that are in there, et cetera, et cetera. And so are you seeing, you say that it's got anti-forces. So are you seeing, how is that demonstrating or manifesting when you see this pushback on China? What kind of things are we seeing?
Well, one, the northern armed groups, although they are trying to have to dialogue with the military, but meanwhile, the military junta is bombing their villages and towns still. So that is creating also distrust, you know, of junta, but also it really erodes the China's credibility. You know, China is not able to stop the military from bombing the civilians and towns and villages. So it really doesn't hold. And a lot of people, you know, I see it a lot online and all across anti-China sentiment, as well as there's boycotts, there are protests, and not inside Myanmar because they couldn't do that, but outside across the globe, the diaspora is protesting as well. So they're doing what they can. But also the resistance side has already guaranteed China that they will not hurt or harm their economic interest, right? But even with that, they still prefer the military junta, which, you know, people hate. You know, like I say, over 80% of the people really reject it. So by partnering with somebody like that, then you are getting the not surprising that China, anti-China sentiment has grown in Myanmar.
Let's pull more on this about the junta that you're talking about. And I mean, particularly their declining control. So despite the military advantage, I mean, you mentioned, clearly they've got much bigger guns. They've got more weaponry. I mean, the control, last time we spoke, a year ago, they had much more control of the country than they do now, right? And so you're talking about control of only about 21%. And this is facing growing resistance from these ethnic armed organizations and the PDF, the pro-democracy forces and stuff that are fighting. And so let me ask you this. Why is the junta consistently losing control? Now, I know that they've got, and I should even be clear, while they have 21% or so of the territory, they've got, you know, very close to 60% of the major cities and stuff, right? Those major areas. Mm-hmm. But what are the key factors that will determine the junta's long-term survival or collapse? I mean, what's going on here? Help us understand better.
Right. The junta at the military forces, even at its best, it was meant to fight along the borders, not the entire country. So that even at its best, but right now, most of the battalions are down to less than 100 people. So,
I mean, to be clear, a company usually has a little bit more than 100 people, and you're saying battalions are down to about 100. They are really skeletons. Continue.
So, but because of all the killed in action and also the defection, they have defection, occurring every day.
I was reading about the watermelons. Have you heard? I
Yes.
don't remember you talking about watermelons last time, but recently I've heard about watermelons. Are you familiar with that term?
Yes,
It's the
yes.
same one.
There, watermelon means a watermelon is green outside and red inside, right? The green is the military color, and red is the NLD, National League for Democracy color. So there are many serving inside the military that are providing a lot of intel for the. So that was another thing. So because of a lot of the defection, these defectors are providing the vital understanding of how the military work. And many of the their, when they do the munition production, weapon production for the resistance side, rudimentary they may be, those skills are coming from these defectors. And then these defectors are the one primary people that are launching the psychological operation, PSYOP, against the military. And that further erode the fighting spirit, the will to fight of the military. Personnel, troops as well. So that's one angle. But another one is the how corruption plays into it is they are the ground commanders are one afraid to report the true ground situation, right? If they have killed in action, they don't report fully of how many has been killed. There are some how many has defected. They don't report exactly. So any given moment, the Nibiru, they don't really have a full grasp on how many troops they have. And I think I had mentioned last time there was a unit in Kachin State that the Nibiru told to attack, and but that unit has not been there for 2 years. So they have these ghost unit, ghost soldier in it. So when you have that level of corruption and you really don't have an effective
No,
force.
you don't.
So
No.
that's why they're losing.
Yeah, so it sounds like well, I don't know. We'll see where this is in a year. We'll talk more about that in a bit, but let's pull then on this the resilience of this resistance that you're talking about. I mean, you said it. I guess my words was against all odds, and you said, well, you kind of saw it coming. But I mean, Myanmar's resistance has remained strong. And it's been decentralized forces have effectively been challenging the military. And I think there has been some infighting amongst the resistance, small compared to the total fighting that's going on. But I don't want to overly state that. But what key factors, political, logistical, external, I mean, have allowed the resistance to sustain this fight for 4 years?
Right. So one of the like you said, is unprecedented level of cooperation between the different group, and especially between the ethnic armed organizations and the PDFs. And ethnic armed organization has been the one that take in these young people and train them and provide arms and then send them back. Or some of them fight with them to provide additional forces that they need in their area, but also some of them go back to their, the heartland of Myanmar and form their own PDFs and then fight against the military. So that has provided that resiliency to the revolution, as well as the involvement of women.
Say more.
65% is our data is showing 65% of the resistant movement is made up of women. And this is unusual from the previous uprising, where like 10% maybe the most. And they bring a different skill set and different, strength to the fight. They really understand non-lethal aspect of the resistance. There are some in the lethal forces, but many of them serve as a the logistic support in medical type of thing. But also they're the one that they serve like a civil affairs. civil affairs forces and U.S. military, where they work with the local villages and villagers and how to keep them safe, as well as, you know, gathering information, a warning system, advanced warning system type of thing. So that add one more angle, one more thing to
not just an angle, but a tremendous number of people at that density, 65% women. I mean, that's just a massive influx of women that are supporting the effort, I would assume.
That's right. And then the third piece is the diaspora. Myanmar diaspora across the globe is
really
mobilized.
Oh, really mobilized, right?
Really mobilized. Even today, like even last weekend, there was a fundraising in Hawaii.
Fundraising. What other things are they doing? They're
technical
fundraising,
support. Technical support, and also political support.
Political support in the
in their countries, right? Like Burma Act is only possible because Myanmar diaspora here has, you know, tried to advocate for that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And same thing with the diaspora living in UK, Australia, Czech Republic, all of them, they are advocating with their governments to make sure the pressure stays on the military. So those are the element that wasn't there before. And that's why everybody think the military was too big to fail, but not anymore.
And when you say before, you mean like in previous
uprisings,
previous coups, 62 or whenever, those previous coups, why the Tatmadaw was more successful than they are in this present 4-year conflict. Yeah, yes. I'm tracking. Okay. Before I go on, maybe I'll just pull a little bit on what you were just talking about. You're talking about the ethnic armed organizations, the EAOs and the PDFs. If I understand that right, you're talking about EAOs are principally in those provinces that are along the their international borders, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because you can say more.
Yes. So EA, ethnic minority lives in the hilly, the border areas, while the Bama majority, which is about a two-third of the country, they live in the called the Bama heartland. It's the Ayawadi Valley area.
Yeah.
Right. So in the past, really the uprising were usually in the border area, but never in the heartland. And the heartland is now against the military.
Yeah.
And that's where the military recruits come from. And that's why Myanmar military has always been Bama-centric, very Bama-dominated. But now they don't have it anymore. So, and also when you were asking earlier about Myanmar military, their logistical is more of a, you know, you live off the local.
Yeah, the problem.
Right. The so they don't have to have a long supply chain, a logistical line. But now all these villages and towns that they would have rely on for logistical support are now against them.
Yeah.
So now they have to supply. So there has been incidents of a unit died of starvation.
Mm. Oh, my goodness.
Because they couldn't get the logistics there. And then they will do the airdrops. But as you know, our airdrops are always inaccurate and you have a lot of wastage. And sometimes they ended up in the side of the PDFs. Yeah, PDFs or EAO ended up with the supplies that meant for the troops. Yeah,
fascinating. So let's pull a little bit on organized crime and transnational impact. So the collapse of the governance has transformed Myanmar, right? And it has transformed it into this hub of human trafficking, cyber scams, illicit drug trades. All of this has spilled over to the neighboring countries. I mean, I edited the book and you wrote about this extensively. And a lot of that was very enlightening for me. But here's the question. How are these criminal networks shaping the conflict and what are the regional consequences for this?
Right. These criminal networks is not just within, you know, the impact is not just in the border.
Say more?
Yeah, Myanmar, but it's spread outside. And even it's all the way to the United States. According to the study, the latest report said $2 billion worth of scams, you know, has people have been victimized. Not $2 billion has been lost as a result of these scam center in the United States
alone. What kind of scams are we talking about?
These are cyber scams. They were traffic people. These are run by Chinese organized criminal gangs. And they will traffic people in, and then those people are forced, abused and forced to do the scam calls. They call it pig butchering. They're like they befriend
pig butchering.
Someone. Yeah, pig butchering. They will befriend some elderly person in the United
And then
States
take all their
and
money.
then take all their money over, eventually. So those are the some of the the activities these scam centers are doing. But what happened is because of all the sanction, the Myanmar military revenue stream has disappeared. Right, so they are having to rely more. They have been involved with these scam center. These scam center and these illicit economy is not possible without military junta's involvement. Before coup, right now after the coup, that is happening. But they are now more reliant on the income that is coming from there. Right, so they are a part of the problem. So as long as the military is there, alive, and the these scams, these illicit transnational crime will continue, and that's not just it doesn't impact not only impact the Myanmar people, but it's all the impact that the region and all the way even to the United States.
When I listen to this talk about this, like scam centers and stuff, it reminds me, maybe you've seen this movie, Beekeeper. Have you heard of it? About a scam center and vigilante that goes in and destroys all this. But the scam centers, they go in and they just actually, strip all the money they can out of these vulnerable people that they call on the phone. I actually have a neighbor, a colleague who was victimized by this and lost a lot. And it sounds distant until you know somebody it happened to, and it then feels, everybody starts to feel vulnerable. I mean, these are horrible things.
Yeah, $2 billion, that's a
That's
lot of
not.
money. That means that many people were scammed. So I think that many in the United States will know someone
Yes.
who has been scammed by these scam operation, which is by conducted by the Chinese organized criminal gangs, right? But the victims that have got trafficked from all over. And the latest thing in, has been this actor from China was traffic into the scam center, and that really opened up the operation a little bit more. It has gotten a little bit more wider attention on this operation. But you were asking about how that does it impact the conflict. Initially, many of them are up in the north, up in the northern part of China-Burma border, and Operation 1027 flushed them
So
out.
1027 is October 27, 2023,
Three,
right?
yes, it flushed them out. So now they left there and they went down to the Thai Burma border. And this is they continue to operate. And as the Thailand is, increasing their pressure on trying to root out this problem, they're moving into like more urban center like Yangon, Mandalay, into inside part of Myanmar. But they will, but they're, even though they were in the border area and, affect the neighbors, but also from Yangon, they can still do whatever they were doing before all across the globe.
Yeah, I mean, that is a reminder of how this conflict is just not a problem that's over there, right? It is affecting globally.
Regionally and globally, yes.
As we think about broader outside of Myanmar, then maybe I can ask this question about lessons from other conflicts. And so, I mean, some observers, they expect that Myanmar would have followed a similar path like Syria's drawn out civil war, right? I mean, that went on for some time. And yet the dynamics didn't, they unfolded differently. It didn't unfold like that, right? And so then we might ask ourselves, what key factors, and I think you've touched on some of these, but maybe you just might pull on them all. So what key factors have set Myanmar's conflict apart from Syria? And then what broader lessons can be drawn from other conflicts that may shape Myanmar's future as we look into the future?
Right.
Yeah.
Like Syria, Myanmar has some different faction on the opposition side, on the resistance side. But different from Syria is that these, different groups are trying their best to try to cooperate.
Yes.
Whereas in Syria, you don't see that. In the Myanmar conflict, even though it's, we can say since the coup, but the conflict has been going on since 1962 and even before that, right? Because all the ethnic armed organization have been fighting against the central to gain some level of autonomy of their territories. So that's one of the reason, you know, when the coup occur, the many of the young people from the mainland or the heartland of Myanmar was able to go to the ethnic armed organization and get training and the resources that they need to do an armed uprising. So that's the, I think that's the major differences. But the similarity is that, you know, the Assad and Myanmar line, you know, they both don't have the people support. And when you don't have people support, it's not tenable. In the past, the Myanmar military has been able to survive because they were able to get majority Burma to support them. Now they have lost that, right? So Assad, you know, fleeing Syria could happen in Myanmar as well. It's not unlikely.
No, that's true. That's true. No, I mean, 62, 88, I guess, was another uprising, right, that led to the military taking over in 89.
And in that particular time, right, still majority of the Burma but majority still support the military.
Right.
So that's why the ethnic groups feel that this is the only time, this is a once in a lifetime chance of how Burma majority is supporting their plight. And Burma majority in the past, federal democracy was the dirty word,
Yes.
right? But now everybody is saying federal democracy. Federal democracy. And they are even the Burma themselves are saying, let's do the bottom up rather than top down from central and then to no, they wanted to do that from the start with the ethnic, you know, territories, and then how do we build it back up? So more like the US American
Federal system where
federal
states
system
have
when the
come.
13th state and then come together. So it's more of a that template.
I mean, correct me on what I'm about to say. You certainly know better than I, but I mean, the Bama, I mean, so these are the, which we get the, you know, the name Burma from that majority ethnic population. And then you, we have had Myanmar, Burma has had fighting that has gone on the periphery, on the border areas for a long time. But long before we had this 4-year conflict, there was fighting that was going out in those areas there. And so what you're saying is presently we have more unification with the ethnic groups include along with the majority of Bama people. And so this is a unique thing we have going, and they've, and like you said, you know, they've got the support of the diaspora, and they have all these other things that are unique to this conflict that is making them much more successful in this resistance than they've had before. Did I kind of capture that about?
Yes, you
Okay.
do. And the many people say, oh, they want it from external international community. Where is one group, one person? But I think that that's an old way of thinking. What the this Burma, no, Burma, Myanmar people want was to build from bottom up. And then they are multi, you know, it'll be multi-dimensional, multi-group led effort rather than one. That also make it, you know, while that is could be a weakness, but it's also a strength because no one group, you know, is dominant, and everybody believe that they need each other. They can't get to the end state by themselves. So there's a lot of interdependency amongst the group. So that keep it going. But of course, there are like some level of conflict between, but that, like you said earlier, is minor compared to the larger issue. But many times people just focus on those little tension and conflict within themselves and amplify it. So everybody think it's that way. But if you look at the totality of what they're doing, is an amazing level of cooperation that we have never seen before. And that's why they're able to get to where they are. Their success today is not possible if they're not cooperating in a major way.
Yeah, no, my own research, I think I'd read there's been like maybe some 300 internal fightings that have gone on. And that sounds maybe like a lot. And yet it said that only represents 1% of all the fighting that's going on. So virtually nothing, right? Comparatively, 1% on 99. And so whatever the numbers are, I think the research supports, you know, your point right here is that, yes, there is some fighting, internal fighting, but it is really diminutive compared to the cooperation that's going on.
Right. So none of the ethnic groups are asking for their own sovereign state. They're all asking for more autonomy within the federal system. Even like started at the beginning of the coup, AA, American Army on the West, started to talk a little bit more about they may want their own sovereign. But as they gain a lot of territory, they're starting to see that it's, you know, the reality of governing and the resources, human resources and other things, that it will be better off as a larger system, right? So they even started are saying today, federal democracy, you know, is where they want to go. So everybody, unlike Syria, back to Syria, everybody is agreed upon on federal democracy as a principle. But they, of course, they would have to negotiate, as you know, where they want to be common and where they want to be different. Mm. And that has to occur.
Ooh, no, fascinating. I want to pull a little bit more on this and talk about some possible future scenarios. So, I mean, as we've talked about, there's really no clear resolution in sight. Myanmar is facing multiple possible futures. I laid out some of those, but, you know, in the opening, I mean, obviously a prolonged civil war, a fractured state, even, you know, complete junta could continue. I mean, there's multiple things, but it could collapse. You've talked about the junta could collapse, and we could have that. But I want you to think critically on this one, and what do you see as the most likely scenarios, and what would it mean for the country or the region based on these scenarios coming to fruition?
Yeah. Right. Well, the prolonged conflict could occur as a result of the neighboring country throwing lifeline to the military junta in Myanmar. What they don't understand is that the military, like I said, is so corrupt. Any type of help they give, it doesn't really go into fighting per se. Mm. It's more into individual pockets. So only a fraction go into that, but it does keep it alive, and it will, it will drag out. You know, the conflict will drag out. So I say this as the military is like a zombie. You know, once you're a zombie, you can't become a human again, but you're a zombie. But, you know, feeding the zombie here and there, the zombie continues, right? So that's where that is. It will never be whole again. And I don't think that, you know, it's down to 21%, right, military control. I don't think it will be able to, it doesn't have enough strength to gain back all the territory it has lost. And, you know, because like I said, they can't recruit anymore. They have weapons and they can do the air, but air attacks doesn't really win the wars, as you know, we know.
Yep. Right.
From the U.S. own experience. Yep. Air attack alone cannot deliver that. So they can throw in there, but also that the zombie will continue to create instability for the region. And military has been the primary source of division. It's divide and conquer. So if military isn't there, then the other group can have more space to negotiate and work together to build a federal democracy, which will be a lot more stable system than the military in charge, because it's on purpose. It's trying to create destruction, right? Because military has been the one creating all the major outflow of irregular migration, because people are fleeing. Mm. As their houses are being burned, their houses are being bombed, the clinics are being bombed, IDP camps are being bombed, hospitals are being bombed. So, you know, they're the creator, because no other group can create that level of mass migration. Even if they have the local conflict, it's just going to be just right. The neighborhood.
Right.
It's not going to flow into the outside, you know, into the neighboring countries. So, you know, for me, it's the as long as military continue and that this stretched out, that it will have a lot of impact on the region, continue to have problem on the region. The second one is if military collapse, and people keep on saying there'll be fracture state. Yes, that is possible, but I think likely is that I'm much more optimistic because of these cooperation, you know, because of their habits of cooperation that will carry them into building peace, right? Habits of cooperation will win the war, and then it will be foundation for winning the peace. So for example, if in 2023, somebody came in and really helped them win the war, they may win the war, but they may not win the peace. But because they're doing the hard work of having to overcome a lot of misunderstanding, you know, a lot of the tension, that will become a foundation for, you know, building a federal democracy. But it will look different. You know, there are 27 federal democracy in the world, and the 27th version. Yeah. So Myanmar will add to the 28th version of, because it's depending on who, what they can negotiate, what they can negotiate, what will be together and what will be different.
So, I mean, you laid out these different scenarios on. So then we could just muddle along and find this, continue to be this war that just goes on for another year and another year. Like you said, you know, the junta could completely collapse. And ideally, however it goes, your point is eventually they rise into this federal system where all of them have a voice in a unified form of government. So as you look out for 2025, how do you see this, this playing out? I mean, what do you think is going to occur this year in the conflict, in the fifth year of conflict?
So far, you know, the military has lost almost all the trade routes, all the border crossing into, you know, for trade. So there's only a few area left, like one in Musel and one in Dachile. But other than that, you know, all the ethnic armed groups are controlling their the trade route. That will continue. I think that will really create it will stop a lot of money flow, right? The revenue income for the military. And on top of it, right now, as we speak, they're going toward the DIB, the Defense Industrial Base. They're coming after the ethnic and the resistant coalition forces are going after the Defense Industrial Base, where, and if they lose that, then War Machine will come to a standstill. Because, you know, you may have the airplanes, but if you don't have the
munitions, right. Fuel, or things like that,
right.
Air parts, you can't do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that there, it's hard to say when they will get to the end state, but where the military is not sustainable. Every day they're losing ground, and especially if they lose the DIB, I just can't see any way to continue. But they are starting to do a lot of, I see, psychological operation, trying to divide the playing into the seams of the all the groups, because there are so many different groups, so they're trying to work at it. But in a way, they have lost their credibility, military, because everything that they do is always misinformation. So whatever they say, nobody believes it. Nobody believes it. So they're doing a concerted effort and stepping up their psychological operation and propaganda machine. But I think that the newer generation, they're a lot more savvier. Tech savvy as well as information savvy, and a lot of the young people that are involved in this revolution, they're well educated, you know, unlike 1988, because 1988 students were grew up in a very close education system. These the newer generation, Gen Zs, they went abroad and they were educated overseas, and they have a lot of in IT wise, they can really do a lot with that. They have been the one that's modifying the drones, agriculture drone to become a military use. So all these innovation on the resistance side will continue, and the military, average mil in the military, the average education is fourth grade.
Oh, wow.
Right. So there's a smart power element that is playing out as well. So they are, and because they are diversify on this side, they're able to adapt quicker, whereas the military bureaucratic machines move very slowly. So I think that we're going to see another level of innovation in 2025 that I couldn't even come up with, because the young people will innovate, as well as I think that they're going after the defense industrial base. And if that is controlled by the resistance side, then the planes will no longer have munition to drop bombs.
Mimi, you're an eternal optimist anyway, and so, but I look forward to watching it over this year and see how that transpires. But I have no doubt that you've got clear vision into where we're going. We've got a lot of several audience questions, so let's turn our attention over to those. The first one's asking us about Aung San Suu Kyi's role today. I mean, what's her current status, and is she doing anything in the political landscape?
Right. Well, she's still in jail, and we don't exactly know where she is, but I understand, what we understand is a very austere condition, and she is going to be 80 years old in June of this year. And her role, the because she has been absent, because she's been in prison, the movement has gone beyond her. Gone beyond her, but she will always have people's heart. She will always be the mother of Myanmar democracy, and people still love her, and people still revere her. But I think her, practically today, her movement it has gone beyond her. And even if she comes out, I'm not sure she will still have the strength to participate. But I think people will continue. I think she will support whatever the people are doing.
You certainly know better than I. So Aung San Suu Kyi is the daughter of Aung San, who was Myanmar's first. I guess he was probably premier underneath the
No,
British.
he was he's considered a father of independence. Aung San Suu Kyi, Aung San Suu Kyi is seen as mother of Myanmar democracy, while her father is the father of Myanmar independence.
Yeah, and then he and his group was assassinated in 47, so that was some time back. This next question is asking about ASEAN and the 5-point consensus. And so, do you see ASEAN members continuing to publicly support the 5-point consensus while privately engaging with the junta? Now, I might note for the group, and you can correct this as well. I mean, this was adopted in 2021 after the start of the civil war. I mean, the consensus calls for ending the violence, inclusive dialogue, humanitarian aid, special envoy, and ASEAN mediation efforts. And so the question is just asking, where does the 5-point consensus play with
Right.
in ASEAN within this conflict?
The 5-point consensus was agreed by Myanmar, the coup leader, in front of everybody. But he went home and, doesn't follow it. But it's just the MO. Any type of agreement that you draft up with Myanmar, he's more likely than not to follow that. He will not follow that. So, for ASEAN, knowing that, they need to somehow, adapt the 5-point consensus. But the number one element of 5-point consensus is stop all
Stop
the
the violence,
violence.
that's right.
And they're the one, military junta is the one that creating all the violence, and everybody else is in response to the violence he and his forces have created. So, because of him not, or the military junta not following the 5-point consensus, ASEAN reputation at a stake, credibility is at stake, because they didn't do anything. There's no enforcement mechanism. So ASEAN need to develop some type of an enforcement mechanism to ensure that, whatever they agreed is credible. Of course, because the 5-point consensus isn't working, each of the neighboring country within ASEAN, you know, neighboring next to Myanmar, Burma, for example, like Thailand and Malaysia, they get the brunt of it. You know, Philippines may not get anything directly, whereas Thailand and Malaysia really feels it. So they will probably have to engage differently than just, you know, ASEAN 5-point consensus, because they do affect it. It affect them directly.
Well answered, thank you. So this next question is asking about the U.S.'s role in Myanmar's future. What actions can or should the United States take to help stabilize Myanmar and support its return to democracy?
Well, U.S. already passed the, Congress passed the Burma Act. Yeah, Burma Act. So, but Burma Act has, the Biden administration has been kind of slow in really implementing the Burma Act in full. So if the new administration is able to take that and then really fully implement the principle and elements and activities that is authorized by Burma Act, I think that will go a long way to really get to the end state. So, you know, and then understanding that, like you said, Myanmar and Burma is a very critical geostrategically in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and what happens in Myanmar can affect U.S. security. You know, one way is, you know, I've talked about the criminal, but also geostrategic balance in Myanmar. Myanmar can change the geostrategic balance in our Indo-Pacific region.
I mean, no, it can. And I think if I was pulling on this a bit, I don't think the United States has ever had much interest in Myanmar strategically. But given the rise, the increase of strategic competition for China, and China sees this area is very important. If we could recognize there may be an opportunity, as you've long been talking about, that the U.S. can take greater strategic interest there and bring about a different future, not just for the people, but the region seizes that opportunity. This next question is asking us about the impact on Karen and Rohingya children. So the question is, what is happening to the children of those two communities amidst this ongoing conflict?
Right. Well, and the Rohingya issue has been more, garnered more attention.
Yes.
But the other ethnic group, and this, you know, especially the Karen people, has also received a genocidal level of oppression over the years. And of course, in those type of environment, the children are always the, you know, the get the brunt of it. The brunt of it, you know, a lot of the parents die. They're all often orphaned. They're under undernourished, malnourished, and then they have another generation of very vulnerable people, right? And in, you know, in the Bangladesh side, in the Rohingya communities, many of them get recruited by the extremist, you know, terrorist groups. So, you know, it, my heart goes out to the children in that type of situation. Yeah, the humanitarian disaster, this type of thing affect the children the most. Yeah.
Thank you for that. This next question kind of touches on some things we spoke about already, but this is about the EAOs and Myanmar's future. And so it's asking, how are Myanmar's ethnic armed organizations reshaping the country's political and security landscapes? And so maybe just put a bow tie on that and tell us what you think about the big difference that the EAOs are making in Myanmar's future.
Yes, the power of balance has changed. You know, before, as I said, the Burma majority dominant country, and now a lot of the power has been shifted to the EAOs, because all the Burma the PDFs has to depend on the EAO support. And then ethnic armed organizations, a lot of the critical natural resources in their territory. So in the post-conflict Myanmar, EAO will have a lot more saying in how the country is, not the Bama majority.
Interesting. Another question. Myanmar's resources, we'll pull on what you were just talking about, and its global interests. So what role do Myanmar's natural resources, such as its rare earth minerals, energy reserves, how do these play in shaping international interests and involvement in the conflict?
Well, rather the international interests is China's interests. Because for China, the Myanmar is a land bridge, or I call it backdoor to the Indian Ocean, as well as so that all the landlocked provinces, for China landlocked provinces, Myanmar is a good way to get out to sea. A second piece is that Myanmar sits at the entrance of the Malacca Strait, the west end of the Malacca Strait, and China has always felt that Malacca Strait is a very vulnerable position for them because 80% of its energy supply has to go through Malacca Strait.
Okay.
So they call it Malacca Dilemma.
So say it's, more. How does Myanmar help resolve that dilemma?
Right. To get the strategic alternative to this strait is having the pipeline that will enable it to bypass the Malacca Strait. So you have now the pipeline from the Jiaopu port, western part of Myanmar, through the Rakhine State, all the way to Kunming. So the pipeline bifurcates Myanmar, actually, north and south. And then they want to put road and railway on top of the pipeline, so then you can have more throughput there.
Interesting.
And Jiaopu port is also it's a naturally deep sea port. So if you can bring tanker, a lot of the oil tankers, you can also park a lot of, warships if you wanted to.
Okay. Mimi, this has been fascinating. The time has screamed by on us. But before I let you go, I always like to ask the guest to share a book recommendation that can help extend what we've learned here today if an audience wants to know a little bit more. So maybe you've got one for us.
Yeah, the book that I recommend first is, I have two books.
Okay.
First, Imperfect Partners, U.S. and Southeast Asia by Ambassador Scott Marcil.
Who is the ambassador? I remember when he was there.
Yeah, he was ambassador to Myanmar, U.S. ambassador to Myanmar during the Myanmar transition to democracy. So he has a ringside seat.
Yes.
As to what's happening. So it's included in his book. But he's also a Southeast Asia expert. So he has served in Philippines and Indonesia. So his book is, if you want to know a little bit more about Southeast Asia, his book is a quick read and a good way to get to know Southeast Asia. And then the second book, it has not been released yet, is by my friend, my dear friend, Sean Turnell, Australian academic. And his book is called Best Laid Plans. And it's about his observation, again, ringside seat to the Myanmar reforms during the Aung San Suu Kyi's administration. So those are the two books I recommend. But the Sean's book is coming out in August of 2025. Yeah,
okay.
So it's not out yet.
So we'll
but if it comes out, I think it will be a very good read. He's a really good writer. So
Well, we will definitely have you on the program again in the future. And thank you for being here again today.
Thank you for having me. Aloha.
Aloha. As we conclude today's dialogue, Myanmar remains at a crossroads. 4 years after the coup, the junta is losing ground. Resistance endures, and China's influence continues to shape the conflict. Will Myanmar's struggle lead to stability or further fragmentation? And how should the world respond? These conversations shape security. Join us March 10th when I sit down with Noor Aina bint Mohammed Norden, Assistant Director of Maritime Security at the Malaysia Institute of Defense and Security, MIDAS, to discuss Malaysia's maritime shield. On behalf of all of us at DKIAPCSS, thank you for being part of this important conversation. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oe.
As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.